Bardolatry Podcast. We are here this week with the typical crew. I'm Gavs.
I'm Olivia.
And I'm Katie.
This week we are discussing stupid teenagers in Shakespeare's plays. Officially, the four we chose, so we wouldn't go too out of control, is Romeo and Juliet from Romeo and Juliet, Claudio and Hero from Much Ado About Nothing, Silvius and Phoebe from As You Like It, and then I think we just generally said the lovers from Midsummer Night's Dream.
Because they're all stupid.
Yeah.
And I'm not actually sure if any of these characters, aside from Romeo and Juliet, are specifically referred to as being in their teenage years, but we figured they act enough like teenagers to count.
Yeah. I'm under the impression, based on their behavior, that Hero and Claudio are, if not late teens, then very early 20s. Although, that wasn't the custom. What was the customary age for marriage in Shakespeare's time, anyway?
Women were in their teens and men were in their 20s.
So, yeah. Claudio acts like an 18-year-old, maybe. And Hero acts kind of like a 16-year-old, so I'd say, like, they're maybe late teens.
Here's yeah, well, how old is Benedict? Because I feel like he's been educated. I feel like he is more, like, late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
And so Claudio definitely have the impression he's kind of one of the younger ones of the crew, but I still feel like he's probably a little bit older than Hero is.
Yeah, and that would fit with the convention, but I do agree. I think Benedict and Beatrice are, like, the older couple.
Yeah.
Because they've had, like, a little bit of a history, and then Hero and Claudio are the younger couple.
And they make all those spinster jokes about Beatrice, so it's like, you're clearly in your late 20s. Go get married. What are you waiting for? You're old and feeble now. No one wants you.
How dare you don't have
a marriage. I know. People in their mid to late 20s who aren't married, you know? Like, that's just...
Well, I mean, that's you just terrible. Have nothing left to
I can't
for.
Even. I can't even imagine what that's like.
Katie, you and I are spinsters, technically, in Shakespearean time.
You're a year younger than me.
Okay, I have a year to go. 25, yeah. You become a spinster automatically.
I think in Jane Austen's world, too, you are in danger awesome. Of spinsterhood.
Woohoo!
Congratulations!
Old and unlovable!
That's okay, I love cats.
Well, since we already started talking about Much Ado About Nothing, let's just go ahead and jump right into it.
Sure.
With Much Ado About Nothing. So, why are Claudio and Hero stupid teenagers?
Because they're the perfect example of what happens when you have poor communication skills in a relationship.
Yeah, okay. There's always something that bothered me about that scene, and I think I talked about it at the end of the podcast last week, but you have Hero's friend Margaret, right? And so Margaret is in on this thing with Baracchio, okay? She's in on it because he tells her, Margaret's going to hear me call her, like, she's going to say Claudio. So that means Margaret knows it's Baracchio because she has a thing with Baracchio, but she's calling him Claudio. So either Margaret is a shitty friend who is, you know, helping, is part of this plot to make her best friend's boyfriend think she's cheating on him, or she is just oblivious and Shakespeare failed. Like, that's just something that always bothered me, is, like, why doesn't Margaret say, hey, this is kind of weird, why should I call you Claudio? Like, why should I pretend you're Claudio?
Yeah. You would think you would demand that of someone if they randomly asked to... Mm-hmm. For you to call them a different name, you'd think.
And it's not like one of those names like Antonio that's everywhere in Shakespeare. It's like, okay, that's just like a generic pet name for your boyfriend now, because I'd believe that if that were true. Okay. But yeah, Claudio's like, you know a Claudio. And also, you're in Hero's bedchamber.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, that could have been innocent enough because she was kind of like, it sounds like she was her friend, but also kind of like her, like, handmaiden. Is that
correct? Yeah, I think that's true. Like,
yeah, so, I mean, it she could be in her room and, like, it like meeting up with Baracchio, but the fact, it still doesn't make sense that in the script part of the plan is for her to call Baracchio Claudio. That just makes no sense. Like, it just kind of makes no sense to me.
Mm-hmm. I think that part of the play is just begging for a fan fiction explaining Margaret's whole motivation behind the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe she's really into role play. I don't know. That's kind of freaky.
Like, that's pretty common for him to ask her.
Yeah. Today I want to be Don Pedro.
Alright.
And if I were Claudio and I saw what I thought to be my girlfriend with some other guy, but she was calling him Claudio, I'd be like, wow, you know, she's not evil, she's just stupid. They met at a mass ball, right? Does she even know what Claudio looks like?
Well, see, that's the point I was going to make. That makes Claudio seem like a middle schooler is when he has Don Pedro woo Hero for him. And I'm like, what? You, like, have to have your friend deliver a note asking whether or not she likes you instead of
at that point,
going up to her yourself?
I like Don Pedro better. I feel like if I were Hero at the end of the play, I'd be like, you know what? Don Pedro was actually nice to me and had the guts to talk to me in person, and you just, like, were in the background being creepy. So...
yeah, especially if you were Denzel Washington, so, you know.
Right?
Yeah.
I know, I think I'm biased toward Don Pedro because of Denzel Washington, but I'm okay with that.
I also like that he's Agent Coulson in the Joss Whedon version, so.
Oh, yeah.
He's a cutie pie. That wouldn't be too bad.
So we're okay with Don Pedro all around.
Mm-hmm.
The other weird thing about Claudio is, I don't know, he just, as far as, like, boyfriend material goes in Shakespeare plays, I think he's kind of at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
Because he seriously has some jealousy issues and problems communicating.
Well, that makes me think of, and we can talk about this when we talk about Romeo and Juliet, but he's so hot-blooded and jumps to conclusions so quickly that it's that kind of, like, passion and jumping the gun that makes me think he's so young.
Mm.
He doesn't really ever think things through.
Yeah, But then again, I mean, this is a totally different play with characters that are older, but Othello does the same exact thing. And this is to someone he's been married to, so he knows her, and he jumps the gun. Like, I'm actually kind of, even though I think Claudio is a hot-blooded idiot, like, I'm kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt here, because he's only known Hero for, like, what, a week? Like, he doesn't really know her. So it's like... It would be more believable that she could be unfaithful if they had just met each other, even though it's totally untrue. I'm just saying that he's not the only one that jumps to conclusions, and he's a bit younger, so maybe we should cut him some slack, but not really, because...
Well, I was going to say, so if you thought you saw your fiancé cheating on you, why would you wait until, like, your actual wedding ceremony to roll that out? Like, just burst up into the room and start yelling.
Because it's dramatic!
Also, you have, like, mom mentality instantly on your side if on your wedding day everyone's like, scandal! And her father jumps right on the bandwagon, too, isn't he? Like,
yeah,
you shameful...
does. Harlot?
Yeah. You're a daughter of mine. Yeah. And then she
I just think that scene is so painful because it's like Hero can't even, like, I feel like Hero can't even stand up for herself. Her own, like, her own father is, like, I think that's what's so sad about, you know, that patriarchal society is that, you know, you don't even believe your own daughter at first.
Yeah.
And Beatrice is really the only one. I think he only believes Hero when Beatrice stands up for her, but I just think it's so sad that, you know, Hero doesn't... I mean, she protests, but she doesn't really stand up for herself, and she takes Claudio back.
Yeah, that was one thing I wanted to bring up, is that she goes back to him after all of that, which seems, to a modern audience, not like a very happy ending.
Mm-mm. It's one of those quick fix endings that are in some of the comedies where you're like, and these people pair off because plot device. Yay!
Yeah. And I think Hero is much more of like a quote-unquote proper, like, Renaissance woman or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas Beatrice is, like, definitely the rule breaker. So her being, like, demure and going along with it is kind of what she's expected to do. Which, again, is a sad commentary on how that society worked.
So can we really say, like, for stupid teenagers, it's like, well, obviously, you know, Claudio is just, you know, being in the way. But can we also say that, you know, it's really more of a product of their time? That they're not just, like, they're not crazy horn dog hormonal like Romeo and Juliet, and we'll get to that eventually. But, like, I think the reason the poor communication and what happens is just a result of, you know, them being the product of their times. Whereas, on the other hand, you know, they serve as a nice complement to Beatrice and Benedict, who start out with the sort of conflict and miscommunication. Mm-hmm. But, like, you see them talking to each other and working things out. And I think, you know, Shakespeare was kind of on the ball with this, like, hey, people, actual relationships take time.
Yes.
Believe it or not.
Well, I wonder, the question of product of their time, I guess it makes me think, have we really learned anything? Because I feel like if there were a present day Hero and Claudio, and, you know, like, jock high schooler Claudio saw someone who looked like Hero making out with someone else in, like, the bleachers, instead of just confronting her in person, he'd, like, go on Facebook and, like, shame her publicly in their social media forum, or, like, tweet about it angrily.
Yeah, I mean, there's still such a sexist double standard that, I mean, I think it's not as bad that people would just, like, automatically, like, I don't think someone's own parents would automatically not believe their own daughter, but I think in general, you know, if people accuse a girl of cheating, everyone vilifies her, but if a guy is accused of cheating, it's not, like, there's not as much of a, like, a witch hunt, you know?
I totally agree with that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm actually reading a book right now where one of the characters' mothers told her that if her boyfriend cheats on her, then she did something wrong, and I was like,
oh my god.
Why? So, that's definitely a thing that some people, still embrace.
I think just, like, poor handling of relationships is a universal young person. Not all young people, of course, but...
But I think we can all agree that whatever you think about Much Ado About Nothing, Benedict and Beatrice are the main attraction and the reason to read the play.
Yep.
In my opinion,
and
anyway.
Denzel Washington's one of the reasons. Well, that and Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're the couple to be and beat in that play.
Yeah.
It just gives me pause because I think of Shakespeare's personal life and how he was 19, his, you know, Anne Hathaway was, you know, older than him, and he got her pregnant before they got married. And, like, I just wonder if in his plays he's trying to say, like, don't marry someone right away, don't be horny right away, like, you know, with Beatrice and Benedict, because, like, I just wonder if he was ahead of his time saying, like, hey, it's okay if you don't get married until you're in your late 20s, like...
So actually, speaking of rushing into relationships, or maybe using that as a precautionary tale, I'd like to transition to Romeo and Juliet, if that's okay with everyone?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So, I mean, one of the arguments I've heard about this play that I quite like is that it's not supposed to be a tale of thwarted romance that makes you really sad. It's supposed to be an example of how hot-headed teenagers, like, rushing into stuff ends badly.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I see that, for sure.
So, like, how... It's, you know, it's obviously a tragedy that they both die, but how much is it supposed to be like, oh, no, that was so beautiful, and how much of it is it supposed to be like, man, those people were all, like, out of control?
Yeah, I think mostly everyone read Romeo and Juliet when they were, like, in, like, middle school or early high school. And I think when you're that age, like, you sympathize with the teenagers and you see it as sad, but the older you get, the more it's like those kids are so stupid. But I think the tragedy for me is that it shows what happens when parents are too neglectful and too strict, because if the families, like, that's the thing, if the families hadn't been so blinded by prejudice for each other, none of the crap would have happened. And so at the end, you have these parents that, like, oh my god, my kids are dead because they were so afraid to, like, live truthfully. So I actually think it's a really good cautionary tale for parents, if anything.
Yeah.
I could definitely buy that. Like, irresponsible adults are bad.
Yeah, like, even the... Oh, he's not a priest.
The friar?
The friar, yeah. There's, like, the whole scene of him talking about herbs and spices, and he's just, like, basically doing drugs or, like, concocting drugs in his basement, and it's like, these are the role models your kids turn to when
I know.
Your parents aren't
around. Juliet took a roofie from a priest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look at it's her like life. Yeah. Look at her choices.
It's like a PSA. But I think it's also a good indicator of, because the beginning scenes are so comic, and then it just becomes so excessively tragic so quickly around, after, I guess,
Mercutio,
and Mercutio
yeah.
have that fight, and they die, and Mercutio dies, and it's, I think, maybe even a cautionary tale for playgoers, that it's like, yeah, it's all fun and games until you bring the consequences from the real world back in,
mm-hmm.
and look what happens.
I was going to bring up a production I saw of Romeo and Juliet that I really liked, that didn't cast, I think, actual teenagers as Romeo and Juliet, but very young actors who were at least close to teenage age, and they played it where the first couple acts, all of Romeo and Juliet's romantic scenes were basically played for laughs, because they were just being, like, really goofy and stuff, and then in the later acts, when they were being very dramatic, like, I just remember a scene where Juliet's crying in Friar Lawrence's office, and the way they played it, he was basically like, okay, calm down. Like, you are overreacting. And I really liked that, because it was the first time I'd actually seen in production where someone had done that.
I think
people try to play Romeo and Juliet more straight a lot of the time. As the romantic tale that you should aspire to. Marry a dude after a day and die after a week. Okay, so what else about Romeo and Juliet?
I was just rereading the scene of their first meeting and how they're just basically making out at a party, and I was like, typical teenagers! But I do think that the argument could be made, and it would depend on who and how they play it, but I think there's a way to balance, like, super hot-headed passion in the first three acts, and then maybe slowly transition that into something a little bit more mature by the end. And I was just thinking about the way Romeo talks about Rosalind and then talks about Juliet. And you can see in his language that when he's talking about Rosalind, his first love, who he just likes because she was there, and it's like, hey, look, girl, I can fawn over. His language is very self-centered and talking about his pain and what he's feeling and how she scorned him and how he's sad. And then when he talks about Juliet, it's very her-centric, which could just be plain praiseworthy, but might also indicate that he's, like, learning to think outward when he loves.
I mean, he is learning to think outward, but I think the real tragedy of this is that they don't have the opportunity to explore that relationship because, you know, because Romeo, he starts to play off in love with Rosalind, then like, okay, oh, now I'm in love with Juliet. Like, was this relationship really meant to last? I don't know, but the older you get, the tragedy isn't that they aren't able to live happily ever after. It's that they aren't even able to explore the relationship and live to, you know, see if they're actually going to, like, find real love and not just passion, you know what I'm saying?
Or if they were kind of forced into rushing their relationship forward because it was a secret, and if their parents had been like, it's cool, you can date, then maybe they wouldn't have gotten married after, like, 2 days.
And I feel like that potential was there, because when Romeo's at the party, Lord Capulet's like, oh no, Tybalt's like, hey, look, it's Romeo, I'm gonna kill him. And her dad's like, no, no, he's at the party. Like, he's chill. He's a good dude. Leave him alone. So I feel like if, you're right, Katie, if they had that chance, like, I think their families would have eventually not been able to reconcile, but, like, been able to deal with it. But they weren't even given that chance to be like, I have a boyfriend, please don't kill him. Like, just give him a week and see what happens.
Yeah, and I guess Tybalt is really the big instigator in that case, at least.
Yeah, in that scene. Maybe in the whole play.
So maybe everything's just Tybalt's fault.
He crushes love.
Well, I'm just trying to think of it, like, we were talking about the modern day parallels with Hero and Claudio. I'm just trying to, like, I think to when, like, you know, teenagers, you know, their parents don't want them to date a certain person, so of course, because they're rebellious teenagers, they do anyways, and then something awful happens, like, you know, they get pregnant, or something like that, all because their parents were too strict, and that, like I said earlier, I think it's just another example of, you know, sometimes, like, by being strict and doing what, like, you think is best for your children, you're actually, you know, if you're not letting them, if they can't be open and honest with you, then it's just going to lead to craziness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'd agree with that. I was also going to say that one interpretation of Romeo and Juliet I really like to see on stage or film or whatever is actually just straight up, like, causing a racial divide. And having the Capulets be one race and the Montagues another race or religion, just to kind of add, like, a further, this is what it's about, and I think that makes it nice and relevant for a modern-day audience, mm-hmm. since that's something people definitely still struggle with, so.
I wonder if, this is another interesting adaptation that someone could do, I wonder if there's ever been a same-sex relationship with Romeo and Juliet. And
I was just saying that,
there's,
too.
Like, the I'm sure. As well.
Making Romeo a girl or Juliet a boy. And
yeah, or something, yeah. I'd like to see an interpretation like that.
Or you could just be like me and ship Mercutio Benvolio and also have them be that. A secondary. Yeah. But that's for another
episode.
That's the real
tragedy.
Oh, yeah. I am way too in deep with that. I won't talk about it right now.
What's that ship called?
I don't know if it has a name.
Okay, fair enough.
Merfolio?
Merfolio?
Bencutio? I don't know. I'll think about it and get back to you.
Okay.
Okay, so are we good on this front?
Yeah.
Have we reached a definitive decision?
Parting.
Yeah, I think Romeo and Juliet is kind of like, it's one of those things where it's like over... done so much, but at the end of the day, it's one of Shakespeare's simpler plays.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I agree. And I also think it's overdone a lot because everyone recognizes like as a touchstone, but it's also portrayed the wrong way a lot of times in pop culture, so, yeah. I don't know. It's kind of interesting for how not interesting it is sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I always think about the Leonardo DiCaprio, Claire Danes version.
Oh, God. Yeah,
that's just, like, too absurd for words.
Yeah, that version...
That was a whirlwind.
Well, yeah, Baz Luhrmann can't help himself, I guess.
Mm.
I do approve of Mercutio in that version, though.
Yes, the Mercutio version.
Yeah. Oh, my God, that was great.
And Tybalt's actually pretty... if I remember correctly, pretty amusing. I think it's...
John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Although I had the thought earlier today, in that version it seems weird to me that John Leguizamo is a Capulet, but then none of the rest of the Capulets are Hispanic.
Mm.
And that was kind of a weird choice, I think.
Yeah.
Not that they all have to be the same race, but, like, you're kind of opening up this exploration, and then it's like, oh no, but everyone else is white. Except for Mercutio, so.
And the... Yeah, was it the nurse? Yeah. She was Hispanic in that.
Okay. All right.
When you said touchstone, maybe they guys like it, so we'll transition that way.
Because... Another transition!
Also, because Touchstone is fabulous as a character, but we don't talk about him.
True. Yeah, so, Silvius and Phoebe. One of the things I noticed this time around that I hadn't really thought about with As You Like It before is... Silvius and Phoebe's whole thing is kind of more messed up than I originally thought, even though, like, I always thought it was kind of messed up.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, when Rosalind gets on the scene to try and help him out, and then she notices that Phoebe is attracted to her being mean, she starts purposefully being, like, as mean as possible to, like, screw with them. But it totally reminded me of, those guys who go to bars and, like, insult women in order to, like, pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, whoa, this is, like, a really weird... Like, it had never occurred to me before. And then I got kind of weirded out by what Rosalind was doing. And then at the end, the line that kind of disturbed me was when Hyman's finally, like, doing all of the marriage rituals and Phoebe has to marry Silvius because, you know... you can't be without a man.
Mm-hmm.
And Hyman says that Silvius is finally going to earn his, a long and well-deserved bed. And I was like, wait, is Silvius, like, winning Phoebe because he was, like, like, is he the nice guy who, like, finally owned his friend because he waited long enough, and now he, like, deserves her because he waited it out?
Well, he was also her little willing slave boy delivering messages for her to Rosalind, which I remembered after reading through, and I was like, oh, he's just, like, putting in friendship servitude coins until relationship falls out.
Yeah, I was like, Silvius is totally the kind of guy who would complain about getting friend-zoned.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's exactly what it is, because Phoebe even says, like, I'm not trying to be mean to you, and I mean, that can also be played in a mocking way, but the way I read it is that she's like, I'm genuinely not trying to hurt you, I just don't like you that way, leave me alone.
Yeah, and you have, like, that's the thing, you have to do that, or else, like, a nice guy is only looking in tunnel vision, and is going to be like, oh, well, she's not mean to me, so therefore she likes me, and I must own, like, that's the sad truth, you know, and I think not a lot has changed, is that, like, unfortunately, the only way that sometimes you can knock into a guy's head, you just have to say, look, like, I'm not into you that way, like, I'm not trying to be mean, I just, you know, right. You need to understand.
Yeah, and Phoebe did do that, but Silvius was still like, no, one day, I shall win you.
If you pity me enough, it will magically turn into love.
Oh, yes, that's such a healthy relationship.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I always knew, like, you know, half the couples who get married at the end of that play is just a completely, like, plot device-y, like, everyone has to get married.
Mm-hmm. But you mean three quarters?
Yeah, I guess everyone but Rosalind and Orlando. But, yeah, the Silvius Phoebe thing... When we originally decided to talk about them, I was like, oh yeah, they're both just ridiculous. And then this time around, I was like, I don't know, maybe Silvius is kind of a creep. And, like, Phoebe is kind of ridiculous, but I don't think she deserves to have to get married to that guy.
No. And I've seen, like, optimistic versions where Silvius, or I've read about them, I guess, where, like, Silvius, by interacting with Rosalind, like, learns how to be more... good, better as, like, a person and a potential boyfriend. So at the end of the play, when Phoebe's like, okay, I guess I'm stuck with you, you can tell that it's not going to be completely tragic for her, but you'd have to be very optimistic and very careful with the way Silvius reacts to Phoebe and with the way that she treats him from the get-go.
Yeah.
Because if you can see a spark of something, like, she likes him and she's just taunting him and being mean about it, that's one thing. But if she's genuinely just a good person who's like, I just don't like you, I'm sorry... then her ending becomes a lot more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the only instance of that in the play, because I believe there's another, like, kind of another, like, country boy named William who's after Audrey. But, like, she ultimately ends up with Touchstone, which is another, like, you know, like, I just met you! This is crazy!
Call me maybe.
But, yeah, I just find it interesting that there's another case of that ends kind of differently, but it's like, oh, okay, well, Audrey's a slut anyway, so.
And, yeah, that's true, and that ending makes me laugh, because doesn't Hyman himself, like, look at their relationship and he's like, well, I'll marry you, but I don't think this is gonna last, but okay.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what the dig is, but... Yeah. It's definitely not supposed to be a happy marriage, I don't think.
Yeah, like, that's not true love.
Let me see if I can find it.
So it's probably in there somewhere.
Okay. Let's do this.
It also actually reminds me, at least for Phoebe's sake, it reminds me of the Measure for Measure ending with Isabella and the Duke. And it's like one of those...
Oh, yeah.
Now I will marry... I just saved your life, so you don't have to marry that jerk Angelo. Now you will marry me, because I'm awesome. And Isabella doesn't even... I don't even know if Phoebe gets a line either. But Isabella definitely does not speak for the rest of the end of that play.
Phoebe... Yeah, but that actually... I think Phoebe does get a line because...
Yes.
I think in Measure for Measure, it's left so ambiguous that people have played it where sometimes she accepts, and then there are other productions where Isabella does not accept his offer because you can portray that through body language. So I'm not sure if Phoebe speaks or not, but... That's something, like, you could definitely, if she doesn't speak, then you could play up her rejecting that with just body language.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Hyman says to Phoebe, you to his love must accord, or have a woman to your lord. And then he goes off and says some other stuff. And then Phoebe says, I will not eat my word, now thou art mine. Thy faith, my fancy to thee doth combine. So she's basically like, yeah, okay, I'll marry you. But she doesn't sound, like, super excited about it. Yeah, and then to Touchstone, he says, for thy loving voyage is but for 2 months, 2 months victualled. So, it'll last for a couple months, but...
Nice.
Yeah.
I think it's also that in that time, you know, people... Divorce is not exactly a common thing, and people are just kind of... Women are just kind of expected to get married, and it's not, you know, it's not necessarily a given that you're going to love your husband, and I think... Phoebe's just like, well, he's not my first choice, but I need to get married.
Before I turn into a spinster. Because that's the dreaded fear.
And I think you could, like, make... If you made the play lighthearted enough, then you'd just be like, oh, haha, those silly kids. Mm. Now they'll work it out. But I think there's something in there that's, like, a little... Eh.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, the next production of this play that I want to see... Sylvia needs to be wearing, like, a fedora and a popped collar.
Oh my god.
Be that guy.
And then Phoebe's just like, nah. They just, like, changed the ending. She's like, peace, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
In the modern day version.
Yep, yeah.
Phoebe would ditch him.
I will not eat my... I just want, like, a third person to come out of the wings for her and just be like, I like this person better.
Or she says, like, hey, after my experience with Rosalind... I think that I'm gay, haha.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That would be awesome, too.
Yeah. Yeah, she or, Rosalind, Orlando, and Phoebe can just be, like, a cute little together.
Hyman says, you have to marry this guy or take a woman for your lord. And she's like, you know what? I'd rather have the woman.
Yeah.
So, that's cool with me.
Yeah.
That'd be a much better ending.
I agree. All right.
I don't know if Rosalind would agree with that, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe not specifically for Rosalind, but...
Rosalind, I mean, she likes being mean to Phoebe, so... Or she likes pretending to be mean to Phoebe.
Are we good on that front, then?
Yeah.
So we're ready for the last set of teenagers?
The frenzy of teen angst.
So we already talked about A Midsummer Night's Dream last podcast, and how many of these shenanigans are due to the magic... Mm-hmm. In the situation, but I think we can agree that all of these people are totally ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. It's their ridiculousness is just emphasized further with the magic. But they're pretty ridiculous in the first scene when they're like we'll just all run away, and then Helena's like, oh, I'll tell Demetrius, and then he won't want Hermia anymore, and that totally blows up in her face. And why does everybody think that just running away from your problems is a good idea?
Because they're teenagers.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Fair.
Well, I mean they're teenagers, and also like, we have to look at a society where people are not free to marry who they love. So that's what happens when you mix hormones and teenagers with societal patriarchal structure. So.
Yeah, it's another Romeo and Juliet type-ish, like, setup. Yeah. But with, like, the society declaring who can and cannot marry each other, but with a happier ending.
Mm-hmm.
They take roofies from fairies rather than a priest.
If only there had been more fairies in Romeo and Juliet. I finally saw Were the World Mine, so now we can talk about that and I'll know what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, oh my god, yeah. No, that's a great example. And that also goes on the theme of, like, societal barriers preventing people from being with who they love. So I think that movie, like, captures the tone of the original, even though it's completely... different.
Yeah.
Because it has the queer theme.
Yeah.
No, it was such a good production. I really enjoyed it. Gab showed it to me yesterday. I'm very glad. Mm-hmm. So good. Such a good movie.
And I also love how it incorporates the fact that they're in high school, so you kind of have, like, the double whammy of, well, here's, like, a very serious thing that they're dealing with, but then, like, here's also the ridiculous side of it. And I just love how it mixes, like, the magical elements and the teacher just, like, trolling everybody all the time.
Yeah. That movie is definitely a frenzy of hormones, and it's wonderful.
So is, in Were the World Mine, is the English teacher Puck kind of orchestrating all of the madness?
Yeah, I kind of got the sense that she goes between being a Puck and a Titania, because she has, like, the impishness of Puck, where she's just like, I'm just gonna let this kid do what he wants and let all this happen, and yeah, all the students can make out, I'm awesome with it, I'm gonna paint some scene in the background. But she also has...
Well,
Isn't
his name Timothy, is that right?
Yes.
Doesn't he play Puck?
He plays Puck in the production, but I'm wondering if, like, you take the whole movie as kind of like a meta, if the teacher is, like, the Puck of the real world, and then Timothy is the Puck of the version within the version.
Yeah. I also think she's a little bit to Tanya, because she knows when the fun has to end, and, like, people have to go back. Because he'd be like, the whole world's, I can just control the whole world, that's great! And he'd be okay with that, as an impish Puck would be. So I think she has that, like, the power of Shakespeare compels you, but also she has that innate, like, okay, we'll put things to rights now. Sense.
Well, I think even on a more meta level, she's like the playwright because, you know, of course, not all English teachers, but English teachers can be dramatic sometimes. I think she represents, you know, Shakespeare himself. Like, you know, I have to use these devices, and even though, you know, the fun has to end, what have you learned from this? Like, I don't know.
No, it's like a teaching device.
Yeah. I also just have to interject, apropos of nothing, that in this movie there is, like, the dudest-looking bust of Shakespeare that just, like, follows the teacher around and is in every scene with her. Like, he's on the piano, he's in the classroom, and the look on his face is just like, yeah, learn my plays, kids.
We liked to dude bro Shakespeare best. Yeah, and one of the reasons, excuse me, that movie is so successful is because all the things we were just talking about can also apply to the original play version. Like, the teenagers go off, a bunch of mayhem happens, things have to be set to rights, and then they, like, learn a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
After, you know, like, fist fights in the middle of the play and stuff.
Yeah.
Insulting people for being short.
Yeah. I'm also really glad that, what was the other, the boy that Timothy liked, what was his name?
Jonathan.
I'm very glad that he didn't go back to his girlfriend and stayed with Timothy. I was going to be very sad if he, like, didn't like Timothy back. Yeah. I really wanted them to be together.
Yeah, it did kind of the same with Demetrius and Helena in the play, though. I did kind of wonder, like, did he really like Timothy back, or is the teacher just, like, or does the teacher just sympathize with Timothy and want him to have a happy ending? I don't know.
Yeah, I've struggled with that. I've seen the movie multiple times, and I think what the filmmaker is trying to do is, like, kind of hint a little bit at the beginning that Jonathan's, like, more sympathetic and more willing to, like, maybe he's, like, actually making kind of puny attempts to, like, reach out and
he does
admit some stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of one of the weaknesses of the movie that they don't make that a little more clear, if that's what they were going for. Because then it does feel a little bit just like, all right, Jonathan can be gay now because that'll make the protagonist happy.
Yeah, I always struggle with that with Demetrius as a character in general. And we talked a little bit about it last podcast with magic and, like, the effects of magic and is the magic taken off of him particularly? But I like the optimistic reading that it was a love that was true and then just got waylaid and then is now back and true again.
Yeah.
Also, he touched Jonathan's butt.
No, Jonathan touched Timothy's butt.
So I want to believe that was, like, a subtle nod from the filmmakers that it's like, he likes him, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's there. Believe in it.
Well, and one of the things, so I was a TA for a lit class several summers ago, and they read this play, and one of the things we talked about was a lot of what this play is about. I mean, all Shakespearean comedies are about, you know, like, devolving into chaos and then finding order again.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we talked about in this play is, like, a common theme is that love makes you crazy and, like, gets rid of your reason,
mm-hmm.
Which I feel like is a very fitting theme for a group of teenagers because, I mean, and maybe even for adults, like, love just kind of turns you crazy sometimes for a while until you get your head back on straight. And it happens to some of the older characters, too, so, I mean, I feel like we're reaching the conclusion with all the plays that the stupid teenagers are not actually stupid teenagers, but maybe here it's not so much like, hey, they're teenagers, so they're dumb. It's just like, hey, people are stupid when they fall in love.
That's fair.
And when they have societal pressure on them.
Yes.
Yes.
And their parents are not...
Well, if your dad threatens to send you to a nunnery because you like a guy he doesn't like, then you definitely have some problems happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to have a family meeting.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking now that we've talked about all of it that maybe the stupid teenagers aren't as stupid as they first seem to be.
Maybe they're just unfortunate teenagers.
Yeah. They're just being teenagers, and then they happen to have some extra pressures on them that make them act a little dumber.
Yeah.
That they can't really help.
They go for that.
So they're all more like commentaries that are supposed to make you treat teenagers better so they don't act like they act in these plays.
It's true.
It's the real purpose of all the comedies.
It's telling you how to parent and be an adult around teenagers.
Yeah.
Don't exile them. Don't threaten them. Let them have their emotions. And they won't run off.
I mean, I think that's also, like, that's how what we can get from it in modern times. But I also think back then it might have just been laughing at, you know, these teenagers, rebellious teenagers that are like, look at them not conforming to the status quo, like, ha, 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 like, they're such idiots.
Yeah,
I think that really hasn't changed.
I'd agree that that's also a possibility. Like, that wouldn't have happened to you if you just listened to your parents, dummy. But we're more sympathetic.
Yes.
Maybe because we actually have more freedom.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe when you become the parent of a teen, your view of these plays changes.
Well, it reminds me of, I think I read a Tumblr post about The Little Mermaid. And, like, when you're little, when she's like, I'm 16, I'm not a child. Little me was like, yeah, you go, girl. And now, like, 20-something-year-old me is like, you met him 5 minutes ago. Calm down.
Slow down, Crozy. Slow down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your dad should be very suspicious of this. Although he totally should not have blown up all her stuff. That's not cool.
There was extremities happening on both ends of that spectrum.
I mean, maybe if it were Justin Bieber. Maybe.
Not just any old human. You have better standards than that. You're a princess.
Eric is pretty attractive, though.
He is.
You can't deny.
And he is royalty. He is pure of heart.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's... Yeah. Well, Little Mermaid has all sorts of other problems, but this is not a Disney podcast. I guess unless we talk about one day The Lion King and Hamlet, but...
Yes.
I
was thinking about Hamlet, because I always think of him as a teenager, too, but he's really in his 30s, and...
Yes,
Hamlet... surprises me.
Is one that's really strange because it actually in the play says, you know, I think he's like in his 30s, mm-hmm. early 30s. When he references like, oh, I, you know, New York however many years ago and he's been at university forever and all this stuff. But then I feel like the cultural impression of Hamlet is that he's more of a teenager and mm-hmm. I don't really know where that came from. But that's like a debate that people actually have where some productions want to have, like, a young 20s Hamlet, and then other productions lean more on, like, the mid-30s Hamlet, mm-hmm. and it's, like, a very wide range.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe a discussion for another episode.
Yeah. So, I guess, do you guys have anything else you want to say about teenagers in Shakespeare plays? Or do we reach some pretty solid conclusions?
Yeah, I feel at peace with this topic.
Yeah, I feel like name me a play where teenagers don't run away because they're pressured by society. I can't really think of any that don't have that formula.
It's a good homework assignment.
I was gonna say The Winter's Tale had a teenager in it, but she wasn't forced to run away because she was exiled when she was a baby. So.
And she actually came home when she was a teenager.
Yeah, so there's always the exile and leave to die option, I guess.
Well, plus she thought she was like a farm girl, so...
Yeah.
True.
Not as much pressure.
Yeah, I was going to say, her society actually accepted her, even though she wasn't inherently from that part of the world.
Her boyfriend's dad was not cool with it.
That's true.
So
that's true.
That's a whole nother thing.
Oh, man.
Well,
but yay, she's a princess, yay!
Yeah.
Thank God! Just like in Aladdin, where the Sultan's, like, referencing Disney again.
Yes.
Oh, I'm the Sultan. Princess can marry whoever she wants.
Yeah.
Like, woohoo! Loopholes!
It took you 90 minutes to remember that you were in charge?
God.
Dad. We should do a Disney podcast.
Yeah.
I would be all for that.
The Minerva Podcast Network.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe, in the future, look for a Disney podcast from the Minerva crew. Just to remind everyone, we are with Minerva. Our website, which you are probably using to listen to this, is www.minerva.com. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter at MagMinerva, and you can find us on Tumblr. We post new podcasts every Thursday. Bardolatry is one of four, so we are supposed to be every 4 weeks. And next time, we are going to be discussing the problem plays with a special guest host, so that'll be fun for everybody. And if, oh yeah, as always, if you have any comments or questions or anything like that, want to contribute to the discussion, you can leave comments on any of our social media networks or on our website, and we are happy to answer any problems that you have or respond to any points you want to bring up.
If you can find a play that has teenagers in it and they don't run away or get exiled or, I don't know,
something
threaten
like
to pretend to be dead for a while.
Let us know. Very important. And I guess with that, we can just say bye.